Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. Today is Thursday, September 22nd, and I'm opening an informational hearing for the House Interim Committee on Energy and Environment. Welcome. We're going to start today our informational meeting with an update on the bottle bill. So I'd love to have John Anderson and Joe Gilliam come forward.
Go first here. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Anderson, president of OBRC, Oregon Beverage Recycling Co-op. And as I've said, I'm here to give a little update on the bottle bill, at least on the operations side. And I have a flyer that I put together that's on the screen over here. And I will just walk through it quickly. And then if there's additional information that you would like or questions that you have, I'd be happy to answer those. So you can see in the upper left-hand grouping there the return rates for the last 4 years. And you can see the final year we just finished at 64.5%. So
and
we've dropped.
We have these on OLIS, excuse me. Yes. Okay, we have all these materials on OLIS as well.
So we've dropped about 5% over the last 4 years. It looks like so far this year we've leveled off a little bit, but it just hasn't followed long-term historical trends, so I just don't know where this year will end up. But clearly we've seen a significant drop. On the right there, the return distribution, just to give you an idea of where containers are going back, there's about 2,400 convenience stores around the state that OBRC services, and about 14% of the state's return volume is going through those locations. There's about 200 large grocers that are still accepting containers back, and I say large, anywhere from a Safeway, Fred Meyer, to a Thriftway or Ray's, if you know that group of stores, and they're getting about 43% of the volume. And then we have 16 bottle drop locations around the state, and they're currently getting about 43%. We just opened one 2 weeks ago now in Hermiston, and so we're adding a little bit to that. We're probably closer to 44.5% now. So you can get an idea of where containers are going back. A lot of containers relative to the number of locations obviously are going back through the bottle drop centers, and there's a lot of meat on that bone. If you ever want to know more about that, I'd be happy to share with you our thoughts on that. But just moving to the general observations is maybe some explanations for what has happened in our opinion. You know, the return to grocery experience has declined, and of course I sit next to my brother Joe. You know, it's been a tough environment for the grocers as more consumers have abandoned returning their own containers, and they've put those out for the professionals or whatever you want to call it. It's changed the nature of the grocery back room, and it's been really hard for the grocers to keep up with garbage and other things that are brought in, and just a general probably lack of concern for the equipment and cleanliness and so forth. So that's definitely been leading to a decline. Consumers increasingly discarding to garbage or using curbside. I mean, that's really tied to, we think, the inflation adjusted value of a deposit today versus in 1971. I mentioned the gleaners or professionals clearly are impacting the number. And then, of course, the deposit inflation-adjusted value. So moving down to the OBRC operations, we have 8 processing facilities around the state. You can see where they're located there. We collect empties from 2,600-plus locations around the state. We have about 275 employees around the state that are a part of the OBRC team. We've got an operating budget at this point of about $27 million. It's increasing quite dramatically. Every bottle drop center that we open increases that by about 500,000-600,000. And we've been doing about 4 a year. So, you know, close to $2.5 million in additional operating costs every year. And we're talking about trying to increase that rollout because of the amount of volume that's going through our 16 centers. It just is. Our sense is it's not feasible to continue the rollout that we originally planned, which was 4 a year, 45 total. So we expect that operating budget to increase proportionately, and then we're also gearing up for the deposit change in April, where we expect more volume to come in. That's our hope, and I'm sure it will. So more trucks and plants and or plant equipment and so forth needed for that. We're also a partner in a plastics wash and flake business in St. Helens, Warren. And so all of Oregon's plastic bottles that come back get taken out to this facility where they're ground into small pieces and washed and prepared to be recycled into new products, whatever those may be. Did you?
No. I'm just entranced.
Oh, well, you know all that stuff. So we, from a bottle drop standpoint, you probably have heard or seen maybe firsthand our bottle drop green bag account program. We've got, my number's a little stale there. We have 110,000 households now that have signed up for that. I think there was a map maybe on that previous page if you jump back. Yeah, you can kind of see it doesn't mean much, but in the lower right or lower right hand corner, the map there, the blue dots that are all amassed together, each one of those represents an address of a bottle drop account holder. You can see with the 16 centers that we have opened around the state, we don't have the Hermiston one on there, but we have been getting a lot of signups there in the last few weeks. But you can see we have a lot of Oregonians that are taking advantage of the green bag program, and that's basically where we count the container for the customer, put it on an account card, and then they have a variety of options, one of which Joe can speak to that's been very, very successful. So getting back to the next page there, if you would, thank you. We support about 1,200 fundraiser charities all throughout the state. Every group you can imagine comes in usually to our plants in a U-Haul trailer, horse trailer, pickup, whatever. We supply them with the supplies, and they collect those through their groups and bring those back. And then we've just recently opened up another avenue for fundraisers through our bottle drop website. They can sign up to be a featured fundraiser, and they can collect directly through the bottle drop program, have access through the current account holders, 110,000 households that are participating, or they can sign up as a bottle drop customer, basically, and hand out their own bags and specific bag tags to their fundraising group to be filled up wherever and dropped off at any one of our centers. So it's been very successful and well received. We do a lot of public awareness. It's a big state when you're out trying to get into the community, but we have an elementary education program. We've been doing this for probably 5 years now. We have a team of two people that go around the state and do a presentation to third, fourth grade classrooms on Oregon's bottle bill. We don't include anything on the industry or OBRC. It's just strictly about the importance of Oregon's bottle bill, doing the right thing, and improving on the environment and all those things. And we've reached, at this point, over 40,000 young Oregon children over the years. We're at a lot of community events with Bottle Bill. We've spent over $2 million on awareness campaigns. We're in the middle of one now with some statewide media that's really geared towards small deposit, big return. You might have heard a commercial on the radio or two or seen it in some print. So it's been very well received. It's a message that I think people, that resonates with people. And so we hope to continue finding those connections. Next steps and coming changes there. We're looking at doing more than our 4 per year, maybe 6 next year, 8 the next couple of years. It's a big, it's for us a relatively small organization. It's a big undertaking to put it all together operationally, but we think it's necessary based on the volume distribution that we're seeing. We see the statewide return shifting towards bottle drop at a rate of about 4% a year. If we doubled that or doubled our opening, maybe 8%. We think when we're all rolled out, we'll be at about 65% of the state's volume coming through bottle drop. I don't have it on here now, but I do want to, I'll just deviate here. Just, I've heard this question asked. Overall bottle drop, so when a bottle drop opens, stores within a 2-mile radius no longer take containers. Those within a 2 to 3.5 continue to take 24 a day, but that's their maximum. So we have an idea, obviously, when we open, or we're collecting from the stores before we open a bottle drop, so we know how many returns we were getting back. And the bottle drops, compared to what was going back through the grocery stores, they're taking back about 125% of what was going through the grocery store. So we've not lost volume wherever there's a bottle drop. We've actually gained volume. And if you look at some of the larger retailers completely unaffected by any bottle drop redemption center, say you go out to Tillamook or, you know, you go to some city that's nowhere near a bottle drop, you see their return rate has dropped considerably higher than what is in the metro areas, or I mean metro, Hermiston is a metro, but in some of the area, Klamath Falls, an example of a place that we close, you know, it's very geographically isolated. It's doing 120% of what was going through the grocery stores before we opened. So I don't think the problem is bottle drop. There's other issues there. So we expect, perhaps as much as 30% of the Oregon population to be using the bottle drop account program. We're taking the green bag, the bottle drop account program, to rural areas. So right now we have a prototype being built that's going to be placed at Estacada Thriftway in the next couple of months. It's solar powered. It's a box that has our electromagnetic door that customers can use. And so you'll be able to open the door and drop your bag, and our truck, when it's out picking up material, will pick the green bags up as well. And we have about 85 locations in rural areas around the state that we don't expect would ever be reached by a bottle drop redemption center because they don't have enough volume, but they will have access to the kind of unique, iconic feature of the account program. So we're excited about that. We'll be testing that here in the next over the next year. The deposit increase, obviously we all know that, April 1st to 10 cents. We're estimating that the increase, or that the redemption rate, will settle somewhere around 85%. We've been in the business for a long time. I've done this for 24 years. Spent a lot of time thinking about it, but it really is a guess. And maybe not even so much an educated guess, because there's no other state in the U.S. that has gone through what we're about to go through. The only other state with a 10-cent deposit across the board is Michigan. I've put up what their published redemption rates are up there. Their last number of 94.2. I would be surprised. I don't know. I could be surprised. But Michigan's a different type of state, not size-wise necessarily, but just in what is covered in the bottle bill and how the returns are done. But we could see somewhere in the 90s. We just don't know at this point. And then the expansion in January of 2018 will be coming online, and that's, you know, basically everything in 1.5 liters or less that isn't dairy, wine, liquor, medicine.
Formula. Milk,
plant-based milk. So it's basically, it's everything that's not included, or that isn't included now except a few unique things. So, and we estimate that's about 200 million units a year of additional volume that will be going through the system. So that's my update.
All right. Thank you, John. And One of the things that was not on here, though, was that their new hire of a former predecessor of mine coming on as a stewardship officer. So that's really great news.
Yeah. No, I spent 4 hours with him yesterday in the car on our way to Redmond and back. And it was a lively discussion.
Good. Excellent. All right, Joe, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Gilliam. I'm the president of Northwest Grocery Association, representing retailers. So we're the kind of the other half of this partnership in getting prepared for the bottle bill deposit increase and the expansion. And John, you know, covers most of it. We work very closely with OBRC on this as a partnership to get this going. Some of the things the retailers face, as you've seen, is just the amount of volume that's come back in. Is just too much at store level. The redemption centers are working very well for the where we put them in, relieving the retailer of the duty of that at the store level. Getting rid of the mess versus fresh food has been just a huge benefit to the consumer and to the store owner. Separating those two, doing it efficiently because of the cost, it is less expensive for us to do it this way because we're getting the economy to scale. Because John's done such a good job. If you've ever been to the Wood Village Redemption Center and you look at a new one we've opened, it's come a long way since our first guesses on what we needed. It's much more automated. The machines now do about 3 or 4 times faster than the machines at the store. So it's a much quicker and cleaner, more pleasant experience. Our consumers are very happy. The grousing we do get, and we do get some when you first close down a bottle room. And something's changed. So your daily routine changed that day, and you want to know where are your machines. It doesn't last very long once they go to one of the redemption centers because it's so clean and fast and easy. And then the bag program is taken off. It just really changes people's interest in being part of the bottle bill. Well, there's a lot of particularly moms out there who are busy, who have kids, who aren't going to go buy those machines, and they don't want to stand outside and do that. But they will go in the redemption center, and they will use the bag program, and they will drop them off. So that's where we're seeing a lot of new people involved in it. Retailers are getting ready for a dime. We just had our board meeting here this week and talking about education program. We've hired a full-time person to be part of our program, our side of it, and is going to be doing a lot of cashiers. They're a big deal. They're educated on what's actually happening and what the changes are. They'll be the ones who get get the blowback if anybody doesn't like change. Customer service, those folks too. And then also starting early at the people who are using the redemption centers today, that are using the bag program today, to understand that a change is coming. And so we have some pretty good communication avenues to get to them on those pieces. In addition, what we do, many retailers in the state, and Fred Meyer and Albertson Safeway does it statewide, is a program called Bottle Drop Plus, where when you drop your bags at the redemption center, John's folks count them up. You have your account. You can either get cash. The OLCC requires us to have cash, have these kiosks at every store, so anybody who's on the account can get a cash slip and get their money at the grocery store. They don't have to go back to the redemption center to get their money. What Fred Meyer and Albertson Safeway offers is you can exchange that for store credit, and you'll get 20% more. You'll get 6 cents a unit rather than 5 cents a unit, and you spend it in the store. You don't get any cash back, but you got more money to shop for your groceries, and that brings people back to the stores that we've now had them do an extra trip, so it's something to give them more value. We now get one out of every 5 customers who takes money out from their bottle drop account, takes a bottle drop plus tag. So we're getting 20%. We haven't done any electronic media or anything outreach like that. It's always been word of mouth and people standing at the doors marketing it. So we believe now it has very big potential to give higher value. The intention is to, when we go to a dime, is to give 12 cents of value. And so to give the customer something back that makes sense to come back and shop in our stores. So the last piece that really has been working the last few months, too, to make this work for us, we had a lot of non-compliance with the new bottle bill from retailers when we first switched over to this from 2007 forward. And slowly gotten everybody on. We had one last chain, 27 drugstores here, a national chain, that just basically avoided the law, and we were talking with OLCC, and they've now done inspections, and that looks like that problem is going to be remedied. If we get that remedy done, we're going to have about 99% compliance, which is, we can live with that, but we will find you. and you got to do your fair share in this deal. So that's a big plus that we're getting everybody, particularly when the volumes are coming up, everybody's doing their part to make it work.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the total number of units anticipated in 2018?
In 18?
Yeah.
For the expanded?
No, for the entire package, how many units will you guys be processing? It says it'll estimate an increase of 200 million units per year. Increase, what's that stack on top of?
That would stack on top. So today it's about 1.2 billion containers that we're processing. And, you know, when I say we're not 100%. OBRC isn't 100% of the distributors around the state. We're most of that. But beyond that, we don't collect from bars and taverns. So there's a segment of what goes through that when I say OBRC doesn't really entirely represent the state. But we're 1.2 today. We expect if we increase, you know, another 15%. Redemption rate, that's adding another 150 million units, say 150 to 200 million units for the 10 cent impact, and then another 200. So we're talking, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.5 billion units or so by the end of 2018. That's our estimate.
Follow up. And when you take a dime times that, that's 150 million.
In terms of the actual number of, so that was returns that I gave you. Sales would be, you know, if we're getting back 85%, then sales are 100% of that. So sales may go up to in the range of 1.8 billion units. So you're talking, 180 million dollars in deposits. Today we handle 70 some million in deposits that are going through the process.
Follow up. And what I'm trying to get at is the 15% that is basically a tax on folks because they don't take them back. So 15% of what? Because 85% is what you anticipate will come back. 15% doesn't. That's a tax, basically. People could take it back, but they won't. So they'll wave goodbye to that money. I just want to know how much that is.
Well, it's, you know, probably a little bit of a moving target depending on where in the process that you're asking. But if it was 15 million of 1.8, you're going to talk, you know, potentially 35 million in unredeemed deposits.
And follow up, the obvious follow up. Where's the money go?
Well, the money is currently used to fund OBRC's operations, including bottle drop and the facilities that we're opening. You know, I can't, again, this is somewhat of a guess, so I'm somewhat educated on it. Obviously, I work in the industry and have for a long time, but I can't tell you for sure where we'll end up. But we're more concerned about the fee impact on our members, and our members already pay a fee. So to be a part of the co-op and participate in it, based on our best estimates, we're more concerned about the fee impact on our members than any excess of unredeemed deposits beyond what our budget costs would be in a year. And you know, we're looking at bottle drop fully rolled out is $22 million a year in total costs. Just our trucks and drivers and plants and so forth is well over $20 million. So, you know, we've got an expected budget within the next few years of being somewhere in the mid-$40 million a year range, and we're talking about potentially unredeemed deposits being at $30 to $35 million. So we still have a very significant shortfall if we were trying to fund the entire system on unredeemed deposits, which our expectation is that we won't, and we have a fee in place today, and it obviously our members would have to come up with the difference in proportion to their size.
Thank you.
Replin.
Thank you. And I'll just pick up the next follow-up he would have asked had we discussed this. So, and just taking it on that, say you do have an overage after that and say, you know, like 5 million or something, what would you do with that? Would you do rebates?
Great question. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I haven't let my mind go too far down that road.
Okay.
you know, we just don't know what to expect. From our perspective, and I say our, I include Joe in this, you know, we're more at this point focused on how do we put the infrastructure in place to deal with a very significant impact from 10 cents and expansion in a very short period of time. Where do we get that funding? We're much more focused on that than looking down the road and trying to prognosticate, you know, will there be $5 million or $2 million extra or whatever. I just don't have an answer for that. If it ever happened, I would be happy to be here and say, here's what we would like to do.
Follow up. So I think you answered this question partially, and I was going to ask about rural areas and how that's going to work. Are these places going to be on the side of the road or like at rest areas? And do people have to be a member, you know, not a member, but, you know, subscribe with a green bag or whatever, that you could bring them there? Because right now a lot of people leave them in a bag kind of in the recycle centers, and then certain days that you know so-and-so comes to get back bottles and stuff.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's a good question. Well, our rural green bag program would be very specific to grocery stores in rural areas, so they would be sited at, you know, we probably would never have a bottle drop in Seaside. Mm-hmm. So the Safeway in Seaside would have one of these locations. There'd be a kiosk in the store where a customer could sign up, get a bottle drop card right there in the kiosk, and use that. You know, I think one of the things, and again, I've been doing this for 24 years, so I've seen the transition. We, in Container Recovery, Crank days, if any of you remember that, we had a number of years where we were over 100% redeemed. And for a large part of what I remember, starting in 92, we were in the mid to upper 90s in terms of percent. And it used to be that people, if somebody left a bag somewhere, mm-hmm. it was getting picked up. Or if somebody dropped, you guys that have been in Oregon probably remember, there were people that walked the roadsides all the time looking for containers, and that's changed dramatically. You know, I think the roadsides now, we still see some, but they're almost too hard. You know, you have to walk too far between containers. It's easier to go in a neighborhood and go through a curbside recycle bin or to somebody that's left a bag of containers by that bin. And so, you know, my expectation in this, and one of the reasons why we think this rate could go up dramatically, and we hope it will, that's the point of the 10 cents, is that we'll go back to more of what we saw in the, what I remember at least in my high school days in the 80s, and then starting at Container Recovery in the 90s, where it just, these things didn't get discarded. They were worth enough that even if somebody didn't want them, they knew there was someone somewhere that would. And that's not the case today with curbside, where there's a lot of people that just put it in the curbside bin and they abandoned that, you know, the deposit they paid on it. And it actually, at least in some not too much, not too little state, that works very well, and that it's a kind of self-funding program.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Representative Boone, the boxes, you don't have to be a member. The concept is to also offer at least probably a machine, but at the minimum hand counting in addition to the box. So someone doesn't want to be part of the club and doesn't want to get the card and all that kind of stuff, there'll still be the services there to do the counting and get the cash slips out. What we hope, though, is because of the expansion, and you can see the volume we're going to have to deal with, the current system won't take it. So we're trying to get ahead of it, particularly in rural areas. We had not originally contemplated anything over the 45 redemption centers we're going to do. But, you know, time teaches you as you learn these things. And you open your first one, you realize, well, we have to do something for Lakeview. We have to do something for Burns. We got to do something for, you know, coastal towns that have one grocery store in. And so hopefully in a lot of your communities, we'll be bringing that to keep up with the volume.
Follow up. And I appreciate that, because I think you're absolutely right. It's going to be worth enough now. And right now, I'm one of those people who do that. When I do my recycling, I set it beside, I shouldn't even say it on the because now they'll know it's me. But there are people who come to the recycle center every day and go through the glass and they go through the plastic and they pick up the bottles. And so I know people are getting them. But if you do it and the guy's there, you know, because he doesn't want a bunch of bags just sitting around, especially with glass. So yeah. That'll really help. So thank you. And thanks for including us.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
You're very
Madam
subtle
Chair.
Today. I didn't...
Well, you put a barrier
between us.
Normally we're kind
of... She did. Yeah, she did. She moved things around.
Is there some nonverbal there? I don't know. there's lots to go over here, but I'll try to refine it. I guess I want to get back to the original intent of the bottle bill. Some of us who have been around long enough to remember. But as I recall, it was about recycling, right? We don't want to throw this stuff into the ocean. We don't want to throw it on the side of the road. We want to recycle. And somehow we've gotten away from that. And it's the determiner now on whether we're successful or not as a state is redemption. And those are different things. Okay. If I'm going to look at your return rate here, it's gone from 70.9% in 12 down to 64.5% in 15. On return rates. If return is the objective that leads to ecological consciousness, we should be seeing bottles all over the sides of the road, but we're not. So we know where they're going. We know they're going into curbside. They're being recycled. But yet, getting back to Representative Bence's point, yet we're going to impose a cost on all consumers who have just, you know, it's easy to redeem. Or it's easy to put it into the, and it gets picked up, no mess, but it doesn't end up in the, you know, it's not, we don't have bottles and cans laying around. We know that. So I guess it's just still angst within me, because at the point in time that we voted to expand or to increase from 5 cents to a dime back in 2011, we were, those of us that were still around, we remember, we were kind of assured that this would never happen. We'd never get to this point. Somehow the system would work out. So, again, that's just maybe angst on my part. I don't really have a question in there, but I'm just saying, I think that point, we've gotten away from, I think, the original intent of the bottle bill, which is simply to get the stuff processed somehow so it doesn't end up in our landfills or in our streams and so forth. But, Joe, I got a question for you then. When we get to the... yeah, you thought you were getting off. What are the stores going to do with the tsunami that's coming their way in 2018 when we expand the containers and they're worth twice as much as they are now? Because in my neck of the woods, we're not prepared to handle that. So your guys are going to be dealing with that.
Yeah.
Because we're going to have that's a huge volume of containers, and people will be getting their, you know, we're going to see a shift, I think, and it's going to go back to the stores for redemption rather than curbside, because you're talking money now.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, a good deal of my time right now is spent on this network of building not only the redemption centers out. You saw 16 redemption centers carry 43% of the volume.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can get another 14 online, we're gonna get pretty close to that 65% volume, 70% rate. I'm hoping about 70%. 300 stores in Oregon do 70% of the volume before we started this project. So we're starting to make the shift over, and it's. You know, quite frankly, John and I were very thankful that we had the bill we did have, even with the trigger in it and even with the expansion, because the original proposal was to do it in 2010, mm-hmm. right after we added water bottles. I mean, we would have blown up the system at that point. Mm-hmm. So I would love to have a few more years to, you know, always have more time to get this done. You know, I did my homework the last night in school, so always nice to have more time. But we've had a pretty good amount of time. We have some challenges. Real estate's a big challenge. For a while there was a lot of vacant space. Now real estate's tight, so we constantly battle kind of finding the right locations. But it's the reason for your communities we've come up with this red box program, because we have the real estate. We can buy the units. It's buying hardware at that point and getting it in there and then redoing the bottle room so it's a more pleasant experience and keep up with the volume. So everything we're doing in that nature is particularly to take on this new volume, this tsunami you're talking about. When people go to the bag program, that helps us handle the tsunami, because we take those bags and count them. We can count them 24 hours a day at the plant. You don't have to have a person standing in front of the machine doing it right there. So that's where we buy the time and we'll handle the wave. And one of the reasons we do Bottle Drop Plus is we realize it's not instant money if you do the bag program, but you're going to get more than, you're going to get 20% growth on what you put in there in the value of buying your groceries. So it's we're, you know, trying basically consumer-based incentives to make sure this is a pleasant experience.
And if I can just add there, just from a statistical standpoint, if we're talking about seeing a 15% increase with the 10-cent deposit, currently of the 43% going through Bottle Drop, about 15% of that is green bag volume. So we've already shifted 15% of 43, which is, I don't know, what, 7% of the state's volume, away from the traditional return to machine that so many customers have grown to dislike. And you know, we don't see that slowing down in the efforts that Joe and his group are putting into the Bottle Drop Plus program. The 20% premium have really driven that as well. So, you know, we may be able to accomplish a lot, including with the rural program, in converting that volume to where the stores were having to deal with it, going through the machines and emptying the machines into a box that OBRC has to run trucks, obviously, and get it picked up and get it counted, but it's not in the traditional stream of volume. And we may be able to absorb significant, if not all, of the increase in deposits that, or the increase in redemptions that we're expecting from those. So I just want to add that.
So is the bag drop program an addition to the build-out of the redemption centers, or is that an add on top of? You're still shooting for 45 across the state, is that correct? So bag drop's in addition to that?
Yeah, that's correct. So we would have 45 bottle drop locations and 85 drop boxes. But in addition to that, what I didn't mention is we're also looking at putting some locations in downtown Portland. In any other place that would be more of an urban type environment where we struggle to envision how a bottle drop might work, where there's a lot of bicycle traffic, walk traffic, and it'd be hard to pack large quantities of containers 2 miles and so forth. So, I mean, we're trying to be creative in saying where are containers consumed, where are residents at, and how do we put a program in place that looks different than what they're used to and is more attractive than what we've had in the past in hopes that they'll use it. So, I mean, we're not stopping where we're at. We're just trying to infill wherever we think there's a need for it.
Madam Chair, if I may, you know, part of what we're learning, and when you talk about where the money goes and, you know, where all this money goes, when we opened in Wood Village, the very first one, we essentially had four large supersized machines that did all our processing. We didn't have automated stuff. We thought that would be enough. We learned that it isn't. Well, we're 8 years, 7 years into this.
Six. Yeah.
Roughly seven. We're already starting, even though we don't have the others rebuilt, we're remodeling Wood Village. We've got more space there. We're adding another store that's on there now. The volume's going to go up, but now we're modernizing that facility. So as we build out to the 45, right behind us, we're going to remodel Oregon City, which is another early model, our second model, with newer, faster equipment. So we got to invest in that. So there is kind of a double investment going on as you go along to replace equipment. South Salem already has a couple years on it. It's all automated. It's much better equipment, but equipment only lasts so long. Mm-hmm. And so there's a back investment you have to constantly be doing as you go through in order to keep it going. We can't just kind of say, well, we did one. It'll just run by itself. It is belts and hoses and hydraulics and computer equipment going all the time. So we have to constantly be reinvesting in it.
So quick follow-up. So is the prime contributor then to the slow pace of building out these redemption centers availability of suitable locations or the capital to do the construction with or both? Do you have the money?
Well, we both know, but I think to this point, the pace has been dictated by our operational ability to find properties, go through the approval process, zoning, and all of those things.
Would you benefit from having a third-party entity to help you do that, i.e. a developer that could find that property, build the buildings for you, and you?
Well, we use a lot of third-party entities now. I mean, we're not we're using real estate brokers and others. So, I mean, it's just, the, as Joe pointed out, the real estate market's changed dramatically from 6-7 years ago when we started this. And I think, you know, we've looked aggressively in Hood River in your area, and, you know, there is nothing. And when I say nothing, I mean, I've personally driven it. You know, I grew up in that area. There's nothing. And that's what we find in a lot of places that, you know, that it isn't even maybe a price issue so much as just it has to be the right location zoned to take back cans and bottles. And that's always a challenge, too, because no one had tried this before us in the state, so that zoning didn't specifically exist. And but I think we're committed to putting additional resources in, and so doubling it from our perspective, doubling the pace at which we're rolling out from our perspective is, okay, whatever staff and program it took to get for a year, let's just double that. Two teams, go, try to get it done, and... You know, I have hope that we'll do it, but remains to be seen.
In addition to what John's doing, each one of our bigger companies has real estate departments because they're always looking at locations, and, mm-hmm. and they're out there with all their feelers and all their people looking for locations. So, you know, it's just difficult with some of the zoning stuff. And some of it's discretionary. When we first started this, no one wanted to be the first redemption center. Gresham said, no, you know, you guys don't qualify, blah, blah, blah. Wood Village said, come on out. We'd love to have you. We did. As soon as we did, Gresham said, well, I guess we can do that. No one wanted to be the first one off the deal, and we get that. We understand that. But we're a weird animal. I mean, we don't have competition. No one else is wanting to take back bottles of cans. No one's standing in line to do that. So they don't know quite where to put us at times. It's getting better every time we've done one of these. We're now 17 down the road. At least they have something to look at and say, well, if Hermiston can do it and Oregon City can do it, I'm sure we can find a way to accommodate.
Thank you. Rep. Bruton.
Thank you for being here. I had no idea there was this many questions about this subject, but it is. So I always get a little confused, even despite my excellent tour John gave me a couple of years ago, because we pay you the dime or the nickel. But he does all the work, so I'm not sure how that works. But you set up a partnership. So, okay, so could you provide us either today or sometime in the future with some kind of a business model calculus? What does your current financial system look like under today? And what have you modeled to happen after the bottle price, the redemptions?
I can give you the rough model right now, Representative Reardon. Our costs right today, current labor costs, which are going to go up significantly because the minimum wage is going up, and these are usually the entry level in grocery store. Anybody ever worked in a grocery store say my first job was I had to go out and do the bottles.
No, I did too.
Yeah, so you know, we're going to see if you're going to last. So that's where you go first day. Cost us about 2 to 2.5 cents per unit, depending on where you are, depending on your conditions. To manage and handle the every unit that we get back at retail, okay? So when it comes back and we give our nickel back because the consumer is whole, that unit costs us 2.5 cents by the time we take it from the machine, in the machine, bag, storage, labor, cleanup, rodent control, all the things that go with what you got to do to redeem cans. When we have a redemption center, the cost is anywhere from 1.2 cents as low as half a penny per unit. Yeah. So, I mean, your basic business model is that. We can cut our costs in half by doing it this way because of the economies of scale, and we couldn't afford to put the kind of equipment John puts in at our stores. If you've ever had a tour of the redemption centers, it's a massive conveyor system, and there's lots of stuff that go with it. You can't do it in the back of a store. It doesn't work. And that's why the redemption centers become popular, because they're three times as fast, and so you're just processing more equipment and you're driving that per unit cost down as much as you can.
Okay, follow up.
Almost got it. I mean, I understand the in-store dynamics much better, and thank you for that. But really looking at, we're going from 5 cents to 10 cents. What's the total impact on both of your businesses? You talked about being a partnership. You're going to be having a much greater volume of bottles coming back. You're going to be making some investments. I guess what I really want to know is I want to be able to tell my consumers, are these guys just making big bucks off of this change in the future? Are they staying even? Are we doing the right thing? Because that's really what I want to tell my constituents.
If you could send the information, we've got another panel to go through, and I think it might be something that would be easier to explain. And plus, I think we're going to get more information from some of the from some folks on the next panel. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Renee Niedermeyer and Peter Spendelow, please come forward for the second half of the bottle bill.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Renee Niedermeyer. I'm the Director of Government Affairs and Communications for the OLCC. And what I'm going to do today is just briefly talk about OLCC's responsibilities under the bottle bill and the transition from 5 cents to 10 cents. The OLCC has responsibilities to approve the applications for redemption centers. That also includes providing notice to dealers within the redemption center's zones that they either need to participate in the redemption center or provide equivalent services. We also determine the exemptions for dealers who handle less than 100,000 beverage containers a year. We also have responsibility for compliance with statutory requirements. That means that containers are labeled with correct redemption values, that dealers accept containers and pay the refund, that distributors accept containers from and pay the refund. Dealers accept containers from distributors, accept containers from dealers and pay the refund. The third thing that we do, and that's one of the reasons why I think we're here today, is that we receive annual beverage container return data from distributors and calculate the statewide redemption rate. House Bill 3145 in 2011 stated that starting in January 1st of 2016, the OLCC shall look at the redemption rate, and if the number of beverage containers returned for the refund value is less than 80% for the two previous years, then it triggers an automatic rise in the redemption rate from 5 cents to 10 cents in either in the latter of 8 months after the determination or January 1st of the following year. We received the commission received the data in July of 2016 and determined that the redemption rate it was indeed below 80% for the prior two consecutive years. As you can see, 2014 redemption 68%, 2015 64%. So that triggers the automatic rising of the redemption rate from 5 cents to 10 cents. I think it's also helpful to just give a little clarity about what's going to happen in 2018 because I think it's relevant for some of the discussions that we might have today. It requires deposits on all beverage containers except the same ones that are already in the statute. That's distilled liquor, wine, dairy, or plant-based products and infant formula. But it also adds all other beverage containers that the additional products include but aren't limited to things like teas, kombucha, fruit juice, hard cider, coffee, coconut water. There are some changes in the sizes. Currently, water, soft drinks, and beer, those containers require redemptions on everything less than 3 liters or less. For the new items that are going to be added in 2018, those are containers from 4 ounces to 1.5 liters. So from the OLCC's perspective, this is a pretty big challenge. We have a lot of stakeholder engagement and communication that we've been doing. I have to say right off the top that OBRC has been an excellent partner in helping us. One of the things that in communicating this change to distributors and manufacturers, basically, this change impacts a lot of people. It impacts the manufacturers, the in-state ones, the national ones, the international ones. It impacts the public. It impacts the grocers, convenience stores, distributors. So there's a lot of folks to get the information out to. And as we've met with them, what we've learned are some of the logistics around timing. And I'll talk just a little bit more about that. One of that is basically takes, even though people might know this would be coming, it takes a significant amount of lead time to change the actual label on the container. We have some people who have stored products that, you know, products like water might last for 2 years. And we have new product introduction that some folks are thinking they were planning on doing introductions in February, in the middle of February, and then the bottle deposit, the redemption rises in 10 cents in April. So while we've had good awareness, this timing issue has become more of a problem for us, because what the statute says is that every container must be labeled with a proper redemption rate. In reality, if you put that into the market, it's impossible to change out all the products on one day. And so what we, so it's reality, some products are going to have the wrong label on April 1st. I don't think it was mentioned earlier, but if a product is redeemed prior to April 1st, it will get a 5 cent back in the redemption. If it's after, it'll be 10 cents regardless of what's on the label. What the OLCC was going to do was do some temporary rulemaking to provide some guidance, because we understand that it is impossible to change on one day, and provide a little relief for folks. And our intention was to give people to the, you know, we expect people to get compliant on as close as possible to April 1st, but realize it may take, you know, to the end of the year. And so that's still our direction. However, we realized we didn't actually have rulemaking authority to do that. And I'll talk just a little bit more about that. But that also complicates compliance and enforcement. And the reality is we have one staff member who the legislature has allocated to work on the bottle bill, and she started in April. So just real quickly on the rulemaking authority in marijuana and in alcohol, the OLCC has general rulemaking authority to implement the statute. We do not have that general rulemaking authority around the bottle bill. What we do have is some limited rulemaking authority. And so we can create exemptions for containers in 2018. We do have that authority. That would be a big issue to open up. And if we are going to address that, we're going to have to start that rulemaking shortly, because 2018 will be here quickly. We can set standards for the establishment and administration of redemption centers, but we don't have any discretion to set standards for non-participating dealers. And again, we don't have the authority to adopt a labeling grace period for compliance. What we have done is a lot of outreach, and we'll continue to do a lot of outreach. The first thing we did is we educated our own staff. This is what to expect. This is the questions you're going to get. This is how we move forward. We reached out to recycling industry, the redemption centers. OBRC has been really helpful in distributing information. And you heard earlier today that Joe has been talking to, you know, the grocers associations. We've been working with a lot of the lobby who works with the associations, and we've been able to have meetings with them. So, and then we've done consumer and media outreach. We'll continue to do that. So people, we're trying not as much as possible to have people not be surprised that this is coming. That said, we realize that there could be a lot of confusion, so there's some things that we have done. We have put a dedicated section on our website, and on that it has frequently asked questions, a bottle bill fact sheet, it has redemption center maps, and we're particularly concerned for retailers because they're going to be one of the first line. They're going to be getting the questions from consumers. So we've done posters, and these are all available on our website. Posters, signage, shelf tags, information sheets. We have a QR code with links to our website and clerk handouts. And so if retailers want to use those are available for them. We do have a listserv. About 2,900 people are connected up to our bottle bill listserv right now. We're working on earned media, and we do have a dedicated email if people have questions, so we can answer those. It's bottlebill@oregon.gov. This is just a quick example of a logo that we're using. We're trying to get folks to understand that this is going to take effect on April 1st, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Go ahead. Can you
give
me, we'll do it.
Sure.
All questions together? Thanks.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Vega, Peace, State Committee. I'm Peter Spendelow. I'm with the Materials Management Section of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And I'll try and be very brief because you've already heard a lot of what's going to be going on. But I wanted to bring us back a little bit to why we have a bottle bill in the first place. So I'm going to skip over most of the slide other than to say that it's been 45 years since the bottle bill passed. It has been 45 years that we've had a 5-cent deposit on beverage containers. That's a long time. The bottle bill was pretty much unchanged. But when you go back and look at it, it was originally a litter bill. That was, although the founders, the people who really were pushing it, really cared about recycling and reuse of containers and resources. As far as the general public was concerned, it was a litter bill. And litter still is an important issue. You see the picture there from Tennessee. That's a recent picture. You still see massive amounts of beverage containers being littered in some places. The other picture there was from about 1974, sort of a publicity picture showing the impacts of the bottle bill. That actually is a little bit exaggerated. But I was a graduate student at University of Washington and did a study back then on litter in Oregon and Washington looking at match sites. And we did find that that about 4 times more beverage containers were being littered in Washington State on match sites compared to Oregon. So it really was an impactful law. But Representative Johnson is right that really by now the big issue is recycling. And that's the thing that the bottle bill does a really good job of getting back high-quality recyclables. The reason for recycling is not to keep stuff out of landfills. I mean, landfills are nice, safe places. It's to save resources. It's to produce high-quality materials that manufacturers can use to make new items. So you can take those aluminum and you can use it to make either new cans or you can use it to make jet planes or things like that. The glass can go back to making bottles. The plastic can go back to making new plastic bottles or other items out of plastic. And with the bottle bill, we have things like that plant in St. Helens that John mentioned that handles only bottle bill material. We wouldn't have that without a bottle bill because all of the plastic we get through our curbside program is so mixed up that we end up exporting virtually all of it out of the country to places where labor is cheaper to do a whole lot of sorting. But with the bottle bill, you get that high-quality, very uniform material. As an example, for instance, think of your glass recycling. People do not put ceramic, coffee cups and Pyrex bowls through one of the reverse vending machines. It doesn't happen. You only get glass bottles going there. But if you look at depots or what's collected curbside, you will find all these contaminants in there. They cause real problems, and you lose a lot of good glass when you go and take out those contaminants. So that's why we really like the bottle bill. And not only does it get back high-quality materials, it gets back a lot of them. And looking at this next – so anyway, looking at this slide here, you can see comparing The redemption rate in bottle bill states versus, not redemption, the recycling rate in bottle bill states versus non-bottle bill states, that the recycling rate is definitely much higher in the bottle bill states. So that is why, you know, we think, why we really like the bottle bill in terms of producing really high quality materials, and you don't end up with some of the problems with our curbside programs where a significant amount of material collected curbside ends up being lost in the sorting process. That you'd have all this commingled material and, you know, aluminum cans and plastic bottles, some of them end up at the paper mills. They don't end up at the recycling where you would like it. One thing we have seen, though, is the redemption rate has been falling. And we know this from our waste composition studies that we do on a regular basis. Back when in 92, when we did our first studies, we found that maybe about 5% of the beverage containers were ending up in the landfills. By 2005, which is the last time we did a really thorough analysis of that, it was up at about 17% going to the landfills. I suspect it's significantly higher now. And why is it higher? It's probably because a lot of it is because of the impact of inflation. A nickel in 1971 has the buying power of 31 cents in current dollars. I mean, that is a really significant difference. And that's why we're supportive of, you know, we were one of the groups that said we really think we need to start doing this because we've had a nickel deposit for 45 years. So anyway, that's just a really quick background, and I'll end there.
Thank you very much. That was a lot of information in a short amount of time, and I love that. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the work on this important matter. Just as an aside, really, we all support the bottle bill. Mm-hmm. What is disturbing is the failure to correctly describe the cost. That's why I asked my previous questions of our previous folk. Because there is a cost, and we need to acknowledge it so that we all know what we're paying for what we're getting. And that's a common complaint that this committee has heard me make many times when it comes to any of our green programs. That aside, what I'm most interested in my question is to OLCC about the problems that you raised. I'm going to pose a hypothetical. I think you're doing a great job. I really appreciated the way you have explained it. I think it leads us ultimately to needing some legislation to help in the little space we have available so that we can reduce the chances of confusion. But the hypothetical is this. Let's pretend someone in my area over adjacent to Idaho has a large barn, and they collect any number of cans out of Idaho, which come over all the time, and also a whole bunch of other of the 40% that haven't been turned in, and just make a haystack of these cans and then show up after the point that the dime is now in place. Because obviously we've got a problem. We don't want to rob people of the 10 cents that they've paid for a can that was inappropriately labeled. But at the same time, we don't want to have to buy every can in Idaho that didn't even pay to begin with. So what a challenge. So to me, since I don't want to impose further costs upon those trying to make this program work, or those stuck with whatever it is we dream up here, we need to know from you what type of legislation you would recommend we pass in the first month of the session to try to help. So what would that – are you working on a legislative concept for us?
We are now. Madam Chair, Representative Benz, we certainly would like to work on legislation to help us with rulemaking ability. I'm not sure that that directly addresses your issue, but we can look at that.
And a follow-up.
And I
want to clear, I appreciate what you're doing. Mm-hmm. It's hard, and I've seen this, you guys struggle with the failure for us to be clear enough in that which we pass before, and you guys always seem to work it out. And so I want to make it clear that I appreciate your efforts.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Representative Benz, I think you're absolutely right. It has to be done in the first month of session because they're going to need that before the April deadline. Anyone else? Thank both of you very much for this. All right. With that, we will move on to the panel that's going to talk short presentation on the small-scale renewable database from the Department of Energy. And so I'm going to have Rob Del Mar and Andy Ginsberg come up. Welcome. And while they're coming up, I know that Representative Palm, Representative Johnson, Representative Reardon, all of you have been working on this question in various aspects, so I'm looking forward to seeing the outcomes of that as we get closer to the 2017 session. This is really just to give a a view of the database work that's happening as we talk about this topic. So thanks for being here, and either one of you can go ahead and get started.
Okay, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I am an assistant director at the Oregon Department of Energy. And with me today is Rob Del Mar. He's a senior policy analyst with the Department of Energy. And as the chair just said, we're here to demonstrate an analytical tool or a model that Rob developed to help stakeholders evaluate compliance scenarios for Oregon's 8% small-scale community-based renewables energy target. The small-scale community renewables are defined in statute as renewables resources such as wind and solar projects that are generating 20 megawatts or less, plus biomass generation of any capacity that produces thermal energy for a secondary purpose such as industrial process heat. We developed this tool at the request of stakeholders so that they could see the effect of different assumptions and policy options about how to calculate compliance with the small-scale community renewables provisions. I want to emphasize that the tool does not recommend any particular assumptions or policy options over others. It simply calculates the effects of assumptions and options that stakeholders are interested in testing. Developing tools like this is one of the important roles of the Oregon Department of Energy, and it falls under our responsibility to provide comprehensive and unbiased data to support policy discussions. The tool's built on data that was provided by Portland General Electric and Pacific Power, and they provided this data to us on a short time scale, and we really appreciated their help with it. In a moment, I'm going to turn this over to Rob to demonstrate the tool and answer any questions you may have about it, but first I'd like to just provide a little brief background to put it in context, and I know we're a little behind schedule, so I'll try and be very brief. Just to summarize this slide briefly, we've been working on assessing small-scale community renewables for a while. We began looking at it before the 2016 legislative session. Then during the session, Senate Bill 1547 passed, which significantly changed the law and also made our original analysis no longer relevant. We then got together with stakeholders to discuss whether or not a revised analysis would be helpful, and stakeholders basically all agreed that building a database to let them do some what-if testing would be the most useful option. In late July, we were asked to demonstrate this tool to a legislative work group led by Representative Johnson. And then in August, we presented the tool also to our original stakeholder group that we've been meeting with. Finally, earlier this month, Rob expanded the tool to include the new analytical capabilities that were asked for by the work group as well as the stakeholder panel. So this is just to briefly summarize the change that happened in statute with Senate Bill 1547 and one of the reasons, or the big reason why this tool was necessary. So first, the basis for calculating small-scale community renewables changed under the original statute. It was calculated based on retail load. And with Senate Bill 1547, it changed to aggregate electrical capacity. So rather than calculating the percentage of energy generated by small-scale community renewables, we now look at the percentage of capacity that they represent. Second, the bill changed the provision from a goal that was applicable statewide to a target that specifically requires compliance by PGE and Pacific Power. Third, the bill included biomass cogeneration facilities, and it didn't include them in the 20-megawatt facility cap that applies to other renewable resources. So the tool allows us to see the effects of these changes and test various ways of calculating, especially the terms that are shown in bold on that slide. So this is my last slide before I turn it over to Rob, and this is just to kind of summarize the key scenarios that can be evaluated by this tool as it stands today. And if there are additional capabilities that would be helpful, we can add them to the tool, provided that the data is available. I'll briefly run through these scenarios, and then Rob will delve into them a little bit more as he demonstrates the tool. So first, the tool can either include or exclude out-of-state facilities that serve Oregon's load. So we can see the effect, the percentage of community renewables. So we just look at those that are physically within the state or including those out-of-state that serve our load. The tool can include or exclude renewable energy facilities that can't be used to comply with the renewable portfolio standard. So, for example, if we have a renewable facility that's that was constructed before the applicability date for the RPS. This tool can say what if it counted or didn't count towards the community renewables goal. The tool can look at including or excluding net metered facilities. So net metered facilities are essentially rooftop solar systems that are on the customer side of the meter. And those systems could be looked at as a load reduction rather than a small scale community renewable when you're looking at it from the utility's perspective. So the tool lets us include them or exclude them. The tool can include or exclude biomass cogeneration facilities that are larger than the 20 megawatt compliance cap that applies to other small scale community renewables. As Rob will show in a minute, there currently aren't any such facilities that would affect the analysis, but of course there could be in the future. And then speaking of future facilities, the tool lets us either include or exclude planned or facilities that are under contract but that are not yet constructed as of the end of 2015. So historically, many of the planned facilities actually don't get built, but on the other hand, other facilities that aren't currently planned may well be built before the compliance year of 2025. And then finally, the tool allows us to compare the capacity approach from Senate Bill 1547 versus the annual energy generation approach that was in the original statute. So many of these scenarios interact with each other, and there is quite a large database of facilities. So this analysis is actually fairly complex when you take a look at it under the hood, which Rob will give you a quick look at now. And so I'll turn it over to Rob, and then you can ask any questions that you have about how the tool works or what it can answer or can't answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, I'd like to just take a moment to give you a brief tour of basically what the tool does and the various tabs that are included in its construction. We'll go through it pretty quickly. There's a lot of data here. We really just want to provide an overview. As Andy mentioned, this is an analysis tool for evaluating progress towards the 8% small-scale community-based renewable energy target in 1547. And so, as you can see, I'm just going to kind of walk through it here. There's a number of tabs here on the tool. They can generally be separated into tabs that contain data and tabs that are actually actively doing some analysis. So we'll just go over here. This is one of the data tabs, and essentially this constitutes the database of projects. This is the data that was provided to us by PGE and Pacific Power in a collaborative effort. They dedicated staff and resources to getting us this data, and a lot of data in a short amount of time, and without good data, the tool would not have much function, so we're appreciative of that. I think now we'll move over to the scenario toggle tab, as we call it. Essentially what we do here is we start by entering a value for the load that we're trying to look at the basis for the 8% target. This is referred to as net aggregate capacity in the bill, and what the values that we're showing now are the peak demand values for each of the utilities. These values are published in the utility's integrated resource plans, which are their long-term planning tools and are published every 2 years. And in our stakeholder groups, we decided that peak demand was a good proxy for net aggregate capacity. So those are the values that we're using. But these are variables. You can go in here and say, what if, and change these numbers. They're just numbers in a spreadsheet. So. Now we'll look at where some of the actual scenario analysis is being completed. Right here, we've got a table that demonstrates the various facility categories that Andy described. The first category we refer to as the baseline contributing facilities, and these are the facilities that no one disagrees about their contribution to the target. They essentially meet the definition of a small-scale community-based renewables. Renewable facility, and so we just count those without turning them on or off. But if you want to look at the impact that out-of-state facilities have, can just check the box, and you can see the impact that that has on progress towards the goal. So in a similar way, you can do that for the net metered facilities. These are the facilities that apply for the RPS. Again, here's the large biomass facilities. There's currently none of those in the mix. And so the user can essentially toggle on and off with these various facility types to evaluate the impact that has on progress towards the target. We did this in this table as an aggregate for both utilities, but then we also did it individually for each utility so that they can look at their progress individually towards the target. So that is essentially the scenario toggle part of this tool. I think it's important to note that this tool is not a report. What we're providing here is a snapshot of where we are in 2016 with existing facilities and 2016 loads. The bill describes a target in 2025, so this is just a snapshot. It's essentially a progress evaluation. And in meeting with stakeholders, they decided that it would be valuable to try to project into the future and look at what's going on potentially in 2025. So to do this, we had to consider both future loads, what we're likely to see for loads in 2025, but also all of the potential facilities that would be constructed. So I'm going to move over to this tab, which is the summary tables. And this is the expanded analysis that enables us to look not only at the snapshot for 2016, but also consider scenarios for, you know, compliance at the target date of 2025. This is really providing just a slice through of all of the data in the database. And we decided that we didn't want to use the check boxes on this analysis for simplicity's sake, and what we really wanted to do was just to tabulate all of these scenarios and provide a table of each scenario's individual impact, and that the person who's, you know, using this tool can go up and evaluate the combined impacts, you know, by just adding up the tables, you know, the pieces that they're interested in. Because the future loads in 2025 are not known, we provided the ability to essentially scroll up or down. Stakeholders said, what if the integrated resource plans are off by 10%? Or, you know, so this essentially provides an easy way to be able to go through and evaluate the impact of changing loads on the compliance scenarios. So, again, we did it aggregated for both utilities and individual for the utilities. I know this is a lot of numbers to digest in a short presentation, but the tool was provided, and if there's questions now or in the future, we'd be happy to address those. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thanks so much for getting this work done in a short time frame to get everybody, to get the information people were looking for as we talk about implementing 1547. Any questions for this panel?
Do we have access for that tool?
I don't. Is the tool available?
It is. I believe that it was shared yesterday in the evening, and it's available on the website that is. Okay.
Is it in the material? Is it on OLIS?
Oh.
Okay. I saw the spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Let's check. Looks like it's PDF'd. Wait, can we get a...
Yeah.
Could we get the Excel file shared with the members?
Yes, we can do that.
Okay.
We'll do it by email.
Okay. All right. Thank you guys very much. Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. This is great work, and I'm looking forward to going through it, but it's complex stuff. Madam Chair, would it be possible to have them back so after we do go through it, we could ask some questions, because there's no use can't do it now.
Yeah.
But it would be great fun, after we had a chance to look at it, to ask them questions about what they came up with.
Yep, absolutely. I think it's the discussions are going to continue with the work group, and then we'll have an update in December legislative days on 1547 mm-hmm. overall implementation, so this can be a part of that.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank both of you. All right, we're going to switch over to Cleaner Air Oregon update. First, we're going to have Palmer Mason and Sarah Armitage. Did you want to come up as well?
Yeah.
All right, Gabriella Goldfarb, please come up. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative advisor for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. You've asked us here today to update you on the Cleaner Air Oregon initiative, specifically the rulemaking around industrial emissions. This is a rulemaking that we are doing in partnership with the Oregon Health Authority, and it is focused on addressing a regulatory gap that exists in our current permitting for industrial facilities, and it is to try to address the gap around the concentrations of air toxics around a facility that might affect homes, businesses, and like that. What we will do today is Gabriella has a few remarks to share with you about the role that Oregon Health Authority is playing in this effort. And I have to underscore they have been a critical partner in making this move forward. And then Sarah Armitage with DEQ is going to give you a little bit of background about what brought us here, what work we have done, and then what work we expect to do in the future. And then, of course, we're happy to take any questions. So thank you.
Good afternoon. For the record, Gabriella Goldfarb, Environmental Public Health Section Manager for the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm going to be very brief. I'm here really to be a resource if you have questions. I do want to affirm the strong partnership that Palmer was just talking about. There was always a great consultation role between the agencies, but the depth of the partnership that this initiative has forged is really something new and important, especially given the intense timeline that we are striving to meet on this. And so it's been a great partnership OHA is bringing to this effort, its public health expertise, which includes not only informing about the health impacts of air emissions, but also engagement with communities. And that's a special strength that I've especially learned about in the public health context. So there's a great presentation from my DEQ colleague, Sarah Armitage, and so I want to turn it over to her and then be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Armitage. I'm with the Oregon DEQ Air Quality Planning Section. So first, I would like to give you a little bit of background, a little bit of review about where we've come in Cleaner Air Oregon and what it does. So Cleaner Air Oregon will reform regulations for industrial air toxics. Industrial use of metals, chemicals, and other materials can result in release of toxic air pollutants, and this can increase the level of risk for people's health. Because industrial facilities are often located near communities with lower income levels and communities of color, some people may be more affected than others. Cleaner Air Oregon will reform rules for what industrial facilities across the state can put into the air. There are other statewide DEQ programs, as you can see on the slide here, and they control air pollution from many sources, including air toxics, to meet federal air quality standards and regulations. A little bit more background on Cleaner Air Oregon. Our existing air toxics regulations for industry reduce toxics for many facilities. They tell facilities how to operate, so they limit the amount of pollutants released into the air. For example, they may require a facility to filter its emissions if it's using a toxic material. However, our existing regulations are based on federal regulations from the Environmental Protection Agency, and they don't take into account specific conditions in our state. They don't cover all industry types, and they don't cover all air toxics. So there may be facilities that are smaller than the threshold that EPA has established, and there may be pollutants that aren't specifically regulated for a category of sources. They don't look at how air toxics affect the health of people living near facilities. So they don't require a site-specific calculation or estimation of risk. As long as you're complying with the federal standard, that's the goal for the EPA regulations. So right now we have an opportunity to strengthen our state program to address potential health risk to people who live near the industrial facilities. So just as a little bit more review about what Cleaner Air Oregon will do, it will determine concentration limits on different substances that affect the health of people living nearby, and it will give us better information to make decisions. It will set limits on toxic air emissions for industrial facilities, and these will be based on impact to human health. It will give businesses clear direction and guidance on the regulations, and this will provide certainty and consistency about how facilities need to operate. And in the process, Cleaner Air Oregon will consider the impact on business, jobs, and local economies. Overall, Cleaner Air Oregon will improve air quality for people living near those industrial facilities. So now I'll tell you a little bit about where we are to date. We've done a lot of work in a fairly short period of time, and it's been very in-depth. In our current Cleaner Air Oregon work, we've investigated six other air toxics risk-based permitting programs in-depth, and we've identified the program elements within there and performed analysis of all of those elements. So what we found is that there are basic elements common to most health-based air toxics programs, including delineation of who they apply to, the use of tools to screen emissions for potential risk to human health, and then they all had some type of more in-depth risk assessment for folks who did not screen out on the earlier steps. And then finally, they all prescribe some level of measures to decrease emissions that would cause unacceptable levels of risk. So we've held four technical work group meetings to get input from technical experts on the pros and cons of different options and the elements that we identified in the other state programs. And we've produced and updated seven issue papers to document both work group and public input and discussion. For each of our technical work group meetings, we had a lot of public attendance and participation. All of our papers and a final report from the technical work group are available on the Cleaner Air Oregon website. So in the materials that we've provided you for today, you will find the membership and the credentials of our technical work group. And we count ourselves very fortunate for the level of expertise and input from these volunteers. We recruited top folks from around the country with expertise in toxicology, air toxics control, and health risk-based permitting programs. And then also early on in our process, we included a focus on environmental justice, and we've been surveying other states across the nation on how they handle environmental justice concerns in their air permitting programs, and we've been documenting those in a separate paper. To date, Health and DEQ have conducted two of four policy forums for interested people and the general public around the state. We have completed Medford and Bend, and next we will be going to Pendleton and Portland. There are many issues to discuss in these forums. There are many issues with creating a risk-based permitting program. For the regional forum discussions, we focused on a few key issues that we thought people would be interested in and we'd like to gather some input on. Those are things like program scope, how we'll approach implementation, how we'll establish air toxic levels to protect public health, and how best to address cumulative risk or the exposure to multiple air toxics from the many facilities and other sources of air toxics that are out there, like vehicle engines, wood burning, and other types of fuel use that produce toxic air pollutants. So the goal of our regional forums is to engage interested people statewide to listen to their input and concerns, and to bring this knowledge to the next step of our public involvement process, which is work with a policy advisory committee. DEQ and Health have selected a 23-member policy advisory committee to provide additional focused feedback on all of the program options. We also have two co-chairs to steward the process. And so the policy advisory committee is our structured way. We frequently use these committees, and it's very important in this process since there are so many issues. It's our structured way to get focused input from a broad array of people with relevant expertise. And the members in our policy advisory committee represent perspectives that include environmental groups, business associations, environmental justice advocates, cities and counties, local health authorities, health advocacy associations, neighborhood groups, large and small business, an industrial union, a pollution control engineer, and an academic with relevant expertise. So this roster is also available in the materials that we've provided to you and on the Cleaner Air Oregon website. We're currently preparing for a series of six all-day policy advisory committee meetings between October 2016 and April 2017. There's a great deal of complexity in developing a health risk-based air toxics permitting program, and we know that working through all these options is a very large task. We've used the foundation of the technical work group issue papers to prepare six discussion papers for the policy advisory committee. These papers further analyze the pros and cons of the various options of a program, and they also leave space for committee discussion and identification and analysis of new options that we have not thought of yet. The advisory committee will also have the benefit of input from participants in our regional forums.
And public comment at every.
Yes, but we're having public comment at every regional forum, and we're building that as we go. So for next steps, it's our goal to have draft regulations prepared and out on public notice next May for approximately 2 months, with the goal of final adoption by December 2017. We, again, expect extensive public comment during this period on the draft regulations. And between August and October 2017, DEQ and OHA staff will be summarizing, considering, and responding to public comment. We may be changing the proposed regulations based on public comments. And then we'll be preparing the necessary documents for our Environmental Quality Commission meeting in December 2017. So there are ongoing engagement opportunities in Cleaner Air Oregon, including the upcoming two regional forums in Pendleton on September 28th and Portland on October 5th. We also regularly update the Cleaner Air Oregon website. You can see there are social media you can follow to get updates on Facebook and Twitter. And we also have an email inbox for the ongoing questions that people have. They can send us any questions, and we'll get back to them that way. All right, so that's all I have for the update. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for this committee? Yeah. Representative Boone.
Yeah, I have three, that's okay. And one is, in my district, a lot of people heat with wood, and so I'm wondering, you had it up there listed with all the other bad things, and I just wondered how you're going to handle it. And, you know, for example, do people get credit for having the newer, cleaner models? And what do you plan to, one of them was, what do you plan to do with it? And it's obviously rulemaking. And then the other piece was, who is in the group and who appointed them? And you kind of gave the categories and sectors they were from, but how did this group get formed?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, let me try to answer those questions. On the question about wood smoke, it's definitely one of the larger sources of air toxics in Oregon, but this rulemaking is focused on the emissions from industrial sources and businesses, so it wouldn't speak to the issue of wood smoke, at least directly. It might come up in the cumulative analysis question, and that's just something we'll have to look at in the rulemaking process. I do want to mention that under the sponsorship of Representative Johnson, there was a bill, House Bill 3068, in the 2015 session that required DEQ to deliver a report as of September 15th of this year, which we did, on wood smoke reduction. And I'm happy to sit with you and talk more about that report. I would say that is an issue worth looking at, because if you talk about air toxics, I think, generally speaking, there's the industrial emission issue.
there's the diesel emission issue, and then there's wood smoke. And wood smoke, I personally think, ought to be part of the conversation in some way. And so, as I say, I'm happy to come and talk to you more about that. On the question about the advisory committee, the appointments were made jointly by the director of our agency and the director of Oregon Health Authority. And this is the advisory committee for the rulemaking. And that was your question, as I understood. And I think you wanted to have a sense of who was on the committee. Rather than maybe read names, I can just sort of give you the groups, but it's in the material that we provided. We're working to identify a tribal member, a representative from the tribal governments. There is neighborhood groups. There's the League of Oregon Cities. There's a couple of neighborhood groups. There's Beyond Toxics, Oregon Association of Counties, Neighbors for Clean Air, Oregon Business Association. There is a business owner representing a business with fewer than 50 employees. Their Associated Industries is also a member. There's, an academic, a union representative, a member of the Environmental Justice Task Force. There's a business owner, a second business owner with fewer than 50 employees. Conference of Local Health Officials.
And Palmer, I've asked her to put it up.
Oh, well, there it is.
There it is.
Better than me reading it. Thank
you.
Much more efficient. Yes.
Okay, thanks.
And follow-up?
Yep, follow-up.
So I guess what I'm getting at is we've been down this road several times before, and it makes me nervous because it's kind of like here we go again, and I want to know what to respond to my constituents when they say what are their intentions and what do they intend to do? Are they trying? And also part of that is to are you considering the differences in the metro area compared with the rural areas? Because it's quite a bit of difference there.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, that is a very fair point. It is, it's a different state. The rules intended to be statewide. We are trying to appreciate those regional differences. That is why we held the, or have set up the regional forums, the public forums that Sarah was talking about in all over the state. We were unable to cover every single corner of the state, but we tried to broadly distribute those so there was sort of maximum opportunity for people from different parts of the state to participate. There are some really difficult questions about what people expect in terms of regulating air toxics. I think, you know, in some communities that have been heavily impacted, they feel very strongly about it. I suspect others may not feel so strongly about it. And so we are going to have to sort through those issues. It is one reason why the rulemaking has a rather extended timeline, is to build in a lot of time for that public comment. And then, quite frankly, what I would expect to be, and I'll be charitable here, a very robust discussion with the advisory committee about how we thread the needle between protecting people's health and balancing costs to businesses. So we've tried to provide ample opportunity through the process to try to get to what I hope is a very protective rule, but a reasonable one. I can't really tell you exactly what that looks like because we really just started on this process.
So
follow up.
And I hate to just beat the point, but if there were any meetings on the coast, I wasn't aware of them. And I look at the difference between driving around in Portland in a neighborhood, for example, and I mean, I grew up in Northeast Portland, mm-hmm. and people who have wood stoves or fireplaces or whatever, whole different thing than the, probably Bence's house out where he lives or my house where I live, you know, where there are two or three houses and then nothing. And if all three houses heated with wood and that smoke was just going, you wouldn't notice it, you know, in that sense. But you might notice it in North Portland if everybody had their fireplaces going. So I guess what my folks are going to want to know is, what does this mean to them? Does this mean that they're going to be outlawed eventually, or how does that work? Because a lot of these people heat with wood because they can't afford other kinds of fuel, or the electricity is so expensive in our area from that particular co-op. It's the most expensive in the state. It's probably double what you guys pay in Portland.
And we'll get into the report, the wood stove report, in December too. I just was afraid we weren't going to have time to get into it today.
Okay.
Because
okay.
It's really, I think for the industrial, I mean, this is going to be for the industrial and business pollutants. But I think that these are great questions to have for the December, when we can really delve into the details of the outcomes.
Yeah, and I understand that, but I just noticed that it was listed about three times on there. So
yeah.
I just wanted to make sure it got on the record. So
thank you.
Yes. So, Chair Vega Peterson, if I could follow up, Rep. Boone, the clarification I think may address your question is that the question is, at what level, what risk level do we set the standards that industries are going to have to face? And one of the questions is, do we take into account other sources in setting that risk level that we're imposing on the business, but it won't have any direct impact on anyone burning, you know, fuel using a wood stove or fireplace? So that, as you all have discussed, okay. is going to be the you know, an opportunity to discuss that through your work on wood stoves. So it's just from a health perspective, do you look at the industrial emissions in isolation, or do you consider other sources, like mobile sources?
I understand that. Yeah.
So, and then one other point, the closest area to your part of the coast that we are meeting is the Portland meeting. However, we are in discussions right now about developing a more nimble roadshow that we could partner with community groups around the state to deliver the same presentations that we're doing in the policy forum in many different other parts of the state. So we're working on that right now. But we have a very tight timeline to try to get the rulemaking, the rules actually drafted. And because there's going to be more opportunities all through this, especially once the draft rules are out for public comment, this is going to be a way to educate people around the state, to empower them to then comment on the draft rules. So
we're
are very
used to
conscious
driving,
of that.
But yeah. Sometimes it's nice to have something local too. So.
Yeah, yeah. I understand.
If you have it on a Friday, there a lot of people will come to the beach on Friday.
That's true.
Representative Bruton.
Just a question, I think. I think at the end of this whole exercise, long, lengthy exercise, I would hope that we are able to have information so we can develop a really good communication system, because I think people want to know, basically, if I walk outside today, how's the air? That's my simple approach. I know it's not that simple, but so is anybody looking at technological advances that are being made in monitoring and then communicating that information so that the general public can have, as you know, a real quick view of how's the air today?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Fruden, yes, there are advances going on, and we are thinking about public information in this process. And so it's happening on three fronts. Two are not directly related to Cleaner Air Oregon rulemaking, and they are monitoring and collecting modeling information, developing models. So with monitoring, we are seeing more real-time readings that we can get back. So, and also, when we can't do real-time readings from a monitor, so it doesn't get transmitted electronically and come up on a screen, we have much quicker turnaround times for the analysis. So we're, you know, we're getting faster and better. And there are screening tools that we can use, so we can have like real-time screening for particulate. That works really well. And if we see high particulate in a community, it's maybe an indicator that there could be toxics there too. So it allows us to kind of, you know, zoom in and do more collection of monitoring information. So it's really improving fairly quickly. With modeling, you know, we do make that available to people. It's a lookup situation, you know, where you have to get on a map, but the mapping, it's generally EPA that sets these up, but the mapping is very interactive, and it's, we also have a Portland Air Toxic Solutions map that's interactive, so you can pull up the map and then go into your location, see their estimates of pollution in the air. So that's another tool. And then in Cleaner Air Oregon, one of the requests that we've had from members of the public especially is making the information really available. So when we know we're going to be getting way more information from facilities in these regulations. Of course, that's not set up yet, but every state has to collect more information when it does a risk-based permitting program. And so, you know, we would like to make that readily available to people online or other quick ways that people could get it.
And if I might add to Representative Reardon, I think you're seeing that the two agencies are working well to get this information out quicker. In particular, I would point out that around some of the facilities that were some of the initial concerns around the air toxics, you're seeing us make announcements quicker if we do happen to see in the monitor around, say, the Bullseye facility, that if there is a spike, we're putting that information out so the public knows, and they know in a more rapid way about what data we have and what we've seen. You know, the longer-term question that Sarah is talking about how we take all this additional information in the rulemaking that we will get for air toxic and air toxics evaluation and putting that out is definitely something we want to look at. I don't know that we have a plan yet about how that could actually be made available to the public. But I just want to stress that we are committed, and I think there's evidence of that, of putting information out more quickly about the public health impacts or potential public health impacts from facilities.
I have Representative Holby, Representative Johnson, and then Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate all the work you're doing on this. I know it's a huge undertaking, but I'm curious about what standards or criteria you're using to establish the health risk levels for the individual toxics. Who decides what that is? And I mean, are you using peer-reviewed studies or already established levels? You know, and will the rules be flexible enough to change those when more information comes out that, oh, actually, this is a lot more toxic than we thought? I mean, that happens from time to time. And so will your rules be flexible so you can adjust that? And then finally, will the information that you give to the public be it's unhealthy level, or will it actually give you the levels of the particular toxic?
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, I'll try to remember all three parts. You might have to remind me on the last one.
If I can remember.
All right. So when the question about how do we set the levels, it really has two parts. First of all, and you know, we've started this discussion with stakeholders and members of the public, it's a question about what acceptable risk levels do you set? So what are you going to allow? What's the allowable risk near a facility to people nearby? And that's not decided at all yet, but you know, it will be under discussion. Other states have risk ranges that they've used. There are somewhere between 100 million up to 25 or even 100 in a million. So it's a band of risk, and we don't know where you know, we're going to end up with this program. That's a really key policy discussion and public health discussion that we need to have. But once we set that level, then the next step, the second step, is to decide which pollutants we're going to cover in this program. And then for each one of those pollutants, our toxicologists and experts look at the toxicology and the medical data that goes with each chemical. And so for each one, there are different levels of certainty. Some of them we have really robust human health data, and others it's animal data that's been extrapolated. But so for each chemical, using those studies about how toxic and how potent a chemical is, they'll be able to say X concentration in the air equals this risk target that we've set. And so that's how we do it right now with our existing air toxics benchmarks. We look at the studies. We look at what California has used to set its concentrations and what EPA has used in terms of the public health studies. And then updating is very important. So you know, right now we have an update scheduled for our benchmarks of every 5 years, and that seemed to work pretty well with us in terms of how quickly the
toxicology data changes, as long as we still have flexibility if something really critical or, you know, a big change happens in understanding of risk, then we have the ability to open at any time and change something. But yes, we have discussed there will have to be some type of renewal and updating cycle for the risk concentrations for each chemical. And then your third part was?
Well, you did really pretty well. I guess when you report this to the public, will you be reporting what the actual concentration levels are?
That's a great question. It may be a little earlier in our process to know. When we do monitoring, we can report actual concentration levels. And then when we do large-scale modeling, we can report estimated concentration levels. With programs that do health-based risk permitting, they generally, if a facility gets through certain screens, like it's emitting too much to screen out and it keeps going in the process, they need to do some type of modeling to estimate the impacts of their emissions on people nearby. So that modeling would give you a concentration level, and from that you would be able to know what's the estimated risk. So yes, that information would be available. It would be public information.
People, one in a million or 25 in a million.
Oh, sure. Gabriella said, let's review one in a million or 25 in a million. So that is the risk people have. It's called excess lifetime cancer risk. And so most air toxics are associated with cancer effects. Some have non-cancer effects. But so we generally refer to risk in terms of cancer. And it's if you are exposed to, you know, that a certain level of pollutant for a lifetime, one in a million is the very low level of risk that you would have. That kind of represents our clean air goals in Oregon right now, and upwards of that are, you know, into the spectrum of allowable risk that is used by EPA and other states.
And if I might add one more, and that is the level of risk above the background level of risk that exists for cancer in a lifetime. It's the additional risk that you would see over a lifetime.
That's important to know, because that background risk is 1 in 3. Yeah.
Yeah. 1 in 3.
1 in 3 cancer risk for people in their lifetimes.
Okay. Representative Dunson.
Oh, I'm up already?
You're up already.
Wow. You didn't move me up artificially, did you, Madam Chair? You're not trying to be nice?
No, I wasn't.
Okay, let me go back to my slide. The slide that was like maybe your second one in the deck talks about today's industrial regulations. Existing regulations reduce toxics for many facilities, but they have gaps. And I guess that's what I wanted to focus in on. By existing regulations, we're talking about the Clean Air Act. Is that correct? I guess maybe this is Palmer. I don't know if that's your question or whomever.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, it does derive from the Clean Air Act. The Clean Air Act amendments of 1990 directed EPA to identify important air toxics and to promulgate standards for the categories of sources that produce those toxics.
So what you're proposing then in this work is to go above and beyond Clean Air Act requirements related to industrial pollution, correct?
Correct. That's correct. And I also neglected to mention those EPA standards are delegated to Oregon, and we administer them in our current state permits, and we also have Title V permits for the larger facilities. But yes, this developing Cleaner Air Oregon project would go beyond existing federal regulations.
Follow up. So in regards to any of these I guess as you look at the gamut of what we would be looking at, does Oregon have any airsheds that are non-attainment with EPA guidelines for any pollutants right now at this current time?
Yes, we have several airsheds that are in non-attainment. Oak Ridge, Klamath Falls, we have a few that are borderline.
Those are particulate matters, correct?
It's particulate
Wouldn't
matter.
Be addressed by this industrial regulations you're talking about, correct?
Well, we do have industrial
pollutants, I guess, as they're defined here.
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, there are no ambient standards, so no EPA standards for how much air toxics are allowed to be in the air, concentrations of air toxics. Okay. EPA sets standards for industry regulations they have to comply with, so there wouldn't be any actual non-attainment areas for air toxics.
Okay. As you go through your work, is there going to be any emphasis on additional data gathering or monitoring across the state? Or are you going to rely upon whatever may be available at the current time?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, we are requesting additional resources for monitoring across the state, both to screen communities for presence of air toxics and then move in and do more detailed monitoring if we think the toxics are there, and also to have types of monitoring that is more flexible. So we would potentially be able to do a compliance evaluation or an audit for a facility that had to comply with the Cleaner Air Oregon regulations. Okay.
As you go through your work, and you mentioned building on the work of other states, i.e. California, and talking about modeling, I'm sure you're probably aware of this, but in other areas, I know other states have launched into modeling for certain air toxics, and the modeling process hasn't been very accurate. So I just want to put that out there to say, just because someone else has done this work, it may not have turned out as well as they had hoped for, and it's been a very long process in some of these states as well. And one final question, I guess. What's going to be, how will the committee, or the work group, I guess, as you call them, how will they reach a decision? Will it be based on consensus, strong consensus? At the end of the day, how will they land on wherever they land regarding what the new rule looks like?
Yeah. Right. Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, the advisory committee's role is really to bring together, or the purpose of the advisory committee for us is to bring together the different perspectives that are impacted by this discussion and by the proposed rule, and for them to give the agency's feedback on the different policy choices that Sarah talked about. The decision about what the rule entails and what it requires actually rests solely with the agencies and ultimately rests solely with the Environmental Quality Commission. So that's really where the decision-making stops, is with the two agencies and with the commission. We're looking to use the advisory committee to be an informed process and help us design a better rule and to make sure that we don't miss critical issues or that we truly understand the implications in both in terms of public health and in terms of, you know, economic cost. But ultimately, the decision-making rests with the agencies and the EQC.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, just to clarify, each member of the committee will be asked to provide their input on an individual basis. So the charge to the advisory committee is not to reach consensus or vote at all. It's to they're going to be in a very short amount of time asked to onboard a lot of technical information and digest that and then provide us with their their individual recommendations. And most of them, as you saw from that list, are representing particular perspectives and bring that expertise from that stakeholder group to the comments that they will provide.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for all your work on this. What a challenging exercise. I had three thoughts. The first, I'm just curious what statute it is that delegates to the commission the decision as to risk assessment. If you could give me that statute, just so I know what it is, that's one. Mm-hmm. Two, in past discussions where the standard adopted by Oregon exceeded the federal standard, it seemed that there had to be that statutory authorization, and that's what I'm asking for, because we are either filling in a gap, if it's all seamless sort of regulation, or we're exceeding that which is required by the federal folk. In either case, I just want to know why we are delegating that particular, or how we have delegated that particular decision to the commission. That would be of interest. The second point, when it comes to what ultimately can be a political process in establishing risk assessment, referencing, of course, the advisory committee, the challenge is going to be how do we get to the data that's used as the foundation for a good decision, and that costs money.
So my question is there going to be a budget request, a budget item, a line item to try to help us reach a better decision? And if so, do you guys have a guess at this point at how much that would be? And yes, and the final question is, if we did nothing, could we anticipate that the court would step in and take this decision away from us? So those are my questions.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I can cover the first one. It's about our authority. And so before we started this process, we consulted with our Assistant Attorney General, and we looked at our authorizing statutes. Oregon ORS 468A gives us broad authority to regulate any type of air toxic to protect public health. It actually talks about air pollutants, but air toxics are in the general definition of odor, dust, fume, anything affecting public health in the air. It also gives us authority to put together a permitting program to protect public health. Mm-hmm. So that is the authority that we're relying on for this program.
And Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I'll try to answer your second question, Representative Benz. So the agency's request budget does include policy option packets or budget requests for monitoring around the Cleaner Air Oregon air toxics. And I'm happy, Representative Benz, to sit with you and provide more information than I'm going to be able to share today. So I'll share sort of what I know, and if you would like to, you know, dive deeper into details, happy to do that. But we are requesting monitoring dollars to set up, and I'm going to, as a layperson, probably oversimplify this, a better network around the state to understand air toxics and what the exposure risk. We're not going to go to the legislature and ask for a monitor in every neighborhood, you know, so we're going to have to take a more limited set of monitors and try to understand what the exposure risk would be. We are looking to try to use what Representative Riordan referred to as some of the newer technologies to try to understand this, including the MOS studies that were used by the U.S. Forest Service. And I think that the idea behind that is that additional information can be used to help calibrate and help understand that the models that individual facilities would actually probably use to understand their risk, or both in the way that Sarah talked about the screening risk, whether they fall in the new regulatory program or not, and if they do fall in the regulatory program, what is their actual risk assessment, the actual concentrations that people might be exposed living nearby. And the resources we get from the legislature can help us understand that that modeling process, that risk assessment process, is actually working. And it could be both in terms of understanding the integrity of the models at the initial assessment by a permitted facility, as well as what Sarah was alluding to, that as the program rolls out and facilities are permitting, we have the ability to go back and check to see that the way we modeled it in the initial permit application and the permit approval process actually checks out later. We have that kind of auditing compliance function. So that's what we're contemplating, the ask that we would make of the legislature, hoping the governor approves that in the recommended budget. But that would be the ask of the legislature around monitoring resources.
Well, how much?
Oh, I'm sorry. it's right now, it's roughly $3.4 million in general fund.
And the final question was the courts. If we do nothing, the courts.
So the question was, if we did nothing, would the courts, would somebody go to the courts and pursue a legal action compelling the state to take some sort of action?
And forgive me for it, but the reason, of course, is what standard would the courts use?
Well, I'll start with the first question. I honestly do not know the answer. I'm happy to go and talk with the Department of Justice about whether there are, you know, someone would have standing and a basis in which to sue the state for non-action. I just don't know the answer to that. I'd have to pose that to them. And assuming there were a lawsuit that someone could bring, that's an excellent question about what standard the court would use to try to judge this. I think, though, what the court would be asked is whether, how and under what conditions to compel the agency to take action. So ultimately, I would think if that played out, the standard setting would still rest with DEQ and ultimately with the Environmental Quality Commission. But I'm happy to go talk with DOJ to see if my representation of how that scenario would play out is accurate. I think that's how it would go.
I want to follow up. So the issue is, of course, if you establish the standard and then someone chooses to sue, does that a standard apply to events already which have occurred? So thus there wasn't a standard before, there is a standard now, and you're at fault and didn't know it. That's what I'm really getting at. And so, I mean, there's three or four different issues in there, but if you would ask somebody to think about that would be of interest.
Yes, we'll do that.
Thank you.
Representative Bruton.
A much simpler question, but if you have multiple air toxins that are coming out, will you be able to add up the cumulative effect on the health of my neighbors and myself?
Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, that is one of the questions that we are looking into. We discussed it with our technical work group, and are discussing it with our regional forums, and also it will be a major issue for the Policy Advisory Committee. So we've delineated several ways we could potentially look at cumulative risk. We know that people are not exposed to just one pollutant at a time. So categories we're exploring and doing pros and cons on evaluations of are multiple pollutants from one facility, multiple pollutants from multiple facilities, the facilities pollutants plus what's coming in from what we call background or all the other sources, engines, wood stoves. And then the other category we're looking at is multiple pathways for risk. So not just the air inhalation pathway, but if the same chemical might be in the soil and, there could be contact or ingestion, or it might be in a fish and, you could have it that way as well. So these are all really key issues for us to explore. It has not been decided yet.
Sounds simple enough.
Any more questions? Thank you all very much for this. I know that you've got a trip to Pendleton next week and up in Portland the week after, so I look forward to seeing you there. But appreciate this update as the work goes. I think this will be something that will continue to be very interesting for those of us in the legislature, and got a lot of work ahead of you in the next 3 months. Yeah. So thank you. All right. Next, we're going to move on to the diesel work group updates and information about the Volkswagen settlement and how that impacts Oregon. So I'd like to call up the ever-patient Senator Michael Denbrough and Kevin Downing from DEQ. Welcome, both of you.
Well, you all are at least as patient as I am, Madam Chair, plus more. I'm Michael Denbrough, Senator for District 23, that's Northeast and Southeast Portland. And I'm here as a member of the Senate Committee on the Environment, Natural Resources and the Environment, and also as the chair of the work group that committee created to work on diesel emissions. And just to kind of put it in context, I'm not sure how familiar you all are with the history of this, but back in 2015, we had legislation, Senate Bill 824, whose purpose was to look at the problem of what I'll call dirty diesel engines or older diesel engines, which are putting out a high level of particulates that have serious health impacts. And this is a problem that over time will resolve itself because as a result of federal regulation, any new engines that are built, beginning around 2008, 2009, 2010, and whether we're talking about on-road diesel or off-road, they have filtering technologies that are resolving this problem. The challenge is that diesel engines are very sturdy, very strong, and they live a long time. And we have, engines that can last for another 30 or 40 years. So the question becomes, how can we, through a combination of regulation, incentives, friendly persuasion, move to a quicker adoption of the newer technology? So when we had the bill in 2015, it quickly became clear that this was a complicated problem and we needed a better understanding of the health impacts, a better understanding of how this problem had been addressed in California, because California was kind of the model for the legislation, but it turned out we really didn't know that much about, at least speaking for myself, I didn't know that much about how it actually came down in California, just, you know, what the challenges would be to meet the broad goals. So we created a work group. Chair Chris Edwards created this work group and asked me to chair it. And we have been able to assemble really a very broad array of stakeholders to work on this. We have legislators, including Chair Vega Peterson, Vice Chair Johnson. We have a couple of senators. We have local electeds. We have agency people. We have representatives of industry, both the on-road side, the off-road side, large fleets, smaller fleets. We have agriculture, logging, construction, of course. We have labor, environmental, and public health advocates. We have Dr. Linda George, who teaches atmospheric science at Portland State University. This has been very helpful. We've had input from people who went through the process in California, have come and appeared in person or over the phone, representatives from agencies and from industry down there. So we've had six meetings. We've assembled a lot of reports and data, and all of that is available to you all on, we have a workgroup website that's actually off of my own personal legislative website. And I will say, colleagues, that one of the benefits of this process has been that in the future, we will actually be able to have work group websites that are a function of the committees that they're part of. Right now, we haven't had the technology to do this, but we wanted to have a website for this work group, which technically was not possible. But it will be possible, and so this will encourage all of you to go out and form your own work groups and know that you will be able to have your own website. So as a result of the six meetings that we've had to date, I'd say that we have a much better sense of the health impacts of older diesel engines. We have a much better sense of where we are currently on the on-road side, because on-road vehicles have to register with DMV. And so we have a sense of the age of the fleets, the number of the trucks, the vehicles that are out there. We have less so on the off-road side, and that's one of the challenges that we've identified. We're getting pretty good data on our public fleets. That has been very useful as well. I'd say we have a much better sense of the history of how this issue is being addressed in California. They've been working on this issue for many, many years, and not all of it has gone smoothly. So we have gotten the benefit of seeing what has not worked and what has worked, and can craft our own program accordingly. As a group, we have talked about and I think largely broadly reached priorities of, as we're addressing this problem, how can we identify metrics for looking at the impacts of diesel, so that if we were creating incentives, where would the dollars go first? Mm. If we're looking at regulation, where does the regulation need to take effect more quickly, and which can be put off into the future or perhaps doesn't need to come under regulation. And that has been a very useful exercise. I would say just briefly, largely, I think we agree that the greatest priority is in those areas of densest population that are affected by the greatest amount of trucks and construction equipment, and where you have the greatest number of vulnerable population, thinking in terms of low income, those who are least able to be resilient in the face of health hazards, younger people, older people, that sort of thing. We've looked particularly at school buses and how we can more quickly move to clean up our school bus fleet. And that's something that really is a statewide problem. And we've also had conversations around transit and how transit plays into these inquiries. In terms of incentives to motivate industry to acquire either retrofit filters or newer engines, newer vehicles, it was fortuitous that as we were having these conversations, the news about the VW settlement came through, because that will be a potential source of dollars to help us to address this and get industry into early compliance earlier than in some cases they would be able to do it if they had to use their own resources entirely. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kevin Downing from DEQ, who is who's the point person for this VW settlement, and can tell you how it is structured, where it is at this point, and how it could become part of this larger effort. And then I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about particular findings, et cetera.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Kevin Downing. I'm with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality and the Air Quality Planning Section. So I wanted to talk to you today about the settlement of federal, state, and consumer claims made against Volkswagen and Audi and Porsche cars, that diesel passenger cars that were built with emission-controlled defeat devices. And specifically, the settlement we're talking about today is about the 2.0-liter engines. There's also infractions that have been determined under 3.0-liter cars. Those negotiations around the settlement of that particular litigation is ongoing, and so we'll see when that happens. There's actually three elements to the proposed settlement. The court published its proposed decree here in June of this year. There was a public comment period. The U.S. Department of Justice received comments, and they're in a digest mode at this point. There's a hearing scheduled for October 18th, in which presumably the court will either make its final determinations or set a date by which they will conclude what the final terms of the decree will be. But this is what we know at the moment. So there's three elements in the settlement. The one is addressing compensation to the owners of the cars. That includes an option for either a buyback or a repair for the vehicles. There's also an element where Volkswagen will commit $2.7 billion towards a program to invest in zero-emission vehicle infrastructure, either including electric vehicle charging stations, hydrogen fueling stations for fuel cell cars, non-branded marketing of zero-emission vehicles, potentially the placement of zero-emission vehicles in car sharing and rideshare programs so that people can gain familiarity with these vehicles without having to actually buy them. But what people will be focusing on is actually the next element, which is a $2.7 billion payment by Volkswagen that will be dedicated to states, distributed states, based on the percentage of cars, subject cars registered in each of the states. Oregon's share of that money at this point will be at least $68 million. This is intended to serve as a mitigation fund to fund projects intended to offset the impacts from the excess NOx emissions, both past as well as ongoing. So even cars with the repair, they're likely to not actually be brought into certification level, so there'll be some excess emissions even from the cars. And the owners of the cars are not required to interact with Volkswagen on this in any way. They can continue to run the cars as is without going through repair or choosing the buyback option. So the court has actually prescribed seven categories of activities under this fund that they regard as being eligible for expenditure. So to give you an example, it includes highway trucks and buses, school buses and transit buses and so on, switcher locomotives. I'm going to forget these now. Cargo handling forklifts. I've just gone blank. But anyway, so there's other categories, ferries and tugs as well. And then there's a category for ocean-going vessels, shore power. So when ships are at the dock, you can provide electricity at the dock that the ships can plug into so they can reduce their hotel loads on the boat while it's in the port, reducing emissions from the engines at that point. And then the decree also allows for up to 15% of the funds from this particular fund to be used for zero-emission vehicle fueling infrastructure as well. So within those, even though those are prescribed categories, there's still an opportunity for the states to identify priorities for how expenditures will be made within that outline of the court. The court is asking the states to develop a mitigation plan that will be a high-level discussion of what the goals are that to be met, the kinds of projects that the state envisions expending the dollars on, a description of the impacts of how relief will be provided to people that are disproportionately impacted by diesel emission exhaust, and other elements. To develop this plan, DEQ envisions engaging with stakeholders over the next several months to talk about priorities and outline how what the proposed mitigation plan will look like in the state of Oregon. We've already had a web page posted where people can find out information about the terms as well as documents from the Federal Train Commission, EPA, and the U.S. Department of Justice, as well as the decree itself if you're inclined to read that sort of text. We're building a mailing list for people interested in learning about what the steps will be taken in Oregon. We are scheduling a webinar for next Tuesday afternoon for people that want to learn about what we'll basically talk about the terms of the decree as we know them right now. But as I say, over the next several months, we'll be engaging with stakeholders to gain input and advice on what the form of a mitigation plan will look like. Not only that, but the legislature itself will also have a direct involvement in this process as well. We understand that we, while we have in statute a clean diesel engine fund from which we normally make expenditures for clean diesel projects, that we need a modification of the language in that fund in order to accept these dollars from Volkswagen. So there'll be an involvement for the legislature to be involved in that aspect of it, as well as the department will be requesting budget authority to accept the dollars, and there'll be a policy option package for additional positions to manage the funds going forward. Any questions? I'm happy to answer them.
Questions, Representative
Vance? Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm curious about the methodology they used in establishing the amount paid. The idea was to offset that which was going to be generated by the cars that had been fraudulently represented.
Right.
So the theory was there's going to be this much diesel emitted, this many more diesel emissions, and therefore it's going to cost some number to reduce diesel emissions. And $68 million is going to get us to the same point. That's the theory, isn't it?
It's, I think, Chair Peterson, Representative Bentz, I was not involved in the negotiation. I'm not sure what the basis on which the numbers were negotiated, whether there was actually a more, as you're suggesting, a potentially a direct calculation about impact versus relief and benefit, or whether it was a number that somebody chose because it seemed what they were willing to pay. I could ask staff from the U.S. Department of Justice, I'm sorry, from the Oregon Department of Justice were involved. I could ask him if there was any more insight that he might have, but I don't know.
That's fine. The follow-up. What I'm really getting at is when we spend the $68 million,
yes,
we should be able to ask how much emission reduction are we getting and at what cost. We know it's $68 million.
Right.
How many tons of emission reduction are we going to get?
Perfect.
So I would really like to see that. Do you think that's going to be available as a result of this investment?
Chair Peterson, Representative Benz, certainly. We can perform calculations for every project that we invest in, as we do now, for the money that we get primarily from EPA. So we calculate the emissions reductions that we get from that, and we can look at applying a value from that benefit based on the estimated impact per ton of, for instance, in this case, diesel PM reduced. And we can also look at a value for the NOx, nitrogen oxide emissions. And so we can use a monetary report as an outcome, but we'll certainly have a report that describes the tons of emissions that we can avoid as a result of the investment made here.
Excuse me, can I just jump in for a sec, Rep? Mm-hmm. Sorry. Thanks, Madam Chair. One of the metrics that I think was a high priority, you know, in our discussions was certainly on the incentive side, what can we do that will leverage other resources? So if we can spend dollars from the fund in a way that attracts additional dollars and thus will really ramp up the amount of pollution saved or avoided, that's, I think, going to be one of the goals. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. The follow-up is this. It's a little more difficult, and it's that we talked about risk assessment previously, mm-hmm. and I was just glancing through some of the materials out of California and other places, trying to determine how much safer our community is going to be as a result of this expenditure, and thus this exercise, and it's difficult. We can't really put a value on human life, but we can at least count. And so we can say, can't we, that as a result of this reduction, we are going to reduce the chances of people dying from cancer by some number.
Yes.
So I would like to see that. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure your committee has been struggling with that. There's a real causation issue because of the failure of appropriate testing mechanisms. But you can ask us that point in your analysis. You follow me on that? Because
yes.
It's one thing to say that so many people are being over a certain baseline suffering from cancer as a result of particular exposure. You can say it. Whether it's true or not is a question. And that is because we don't know where this exposure is occurring. We don't know in what degree. And all the measurements not there. But you can take a shot at it. But I just don't want the report to be subject to the theory of misplaced concreteness. So if you can ask us those assumptions, that would be helpful.
Perfect. We can provide the best level of information that we have available. There are estimates that are provided at the federal level for value of human life, and it is an incomplete metric in terms of how you actually perform that. I mean, there's a lot of issues around terms of assigning that number, but there is a value that's used at the federal level that's actually been applied to the rulemakings that EPA has done, in particular in regards to the diesel controls that are applied to the new engines as well. And then there's also a ratio metric that can be applied in terms of estimating avoided deaths and avoided asthma cases and lost work days and things of that nature. And to the extent that we can provide more of that data when we report out the results of this kind of work.
Thank you.
Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm glad to be able to try to ask this question before Representative Bentz, because he usually asks this kind of question. It's always a good one. Who gets to determine how we spend this money? And you kind of got to it partially, that the department's going to come back with a policy option package. Is it clear under our existing framework, whether it's the executive or the legislative that gets to make decisions about how this pot of money is spent?
Chair Peterson, Representative Helms. So currently in statute, we have a clean diesel engine fund that was established in 2007, and the legislature provided some guidelines in terms of how the department was to scale or evaluate projects for funding under that, and those are outlined in 468A. I'm not sure of the rest of it. And we could build on that, but there's likely, I would suspect, a conversation that will be had, as I say, not only in the fall with stakeholders, but likely with this body as well, in terms of refining those criteria to be used to evaluating projects. To a certain extent, I would argue that there's valuable money to be spent on virtually any diesel engine that's existing in the state of Oregon in terms of reducing emissions from those engines. The challenge we're facing here, of course, is that we have not enough money. Potentially, if we use the terms that the court has outlined, 25% towards the cost of a purchase of a new truck, we could, with the $68 million, which sounds to me like a lot of money, well, we get to 2,000 trucks, more or less, within that realm, of which the universe of trucks that could be eligible for this money is somewhere in the order of 63,000 or so. So the challenge for us is determining within that universe what are the priorities for how we best spend the money to show the greatest rate of return in terms of impact on whatever the metrics that we care about, public health, motivating people to change, as whatever else that people will decide that are important for us over the next few months.
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
Not sure you got to the nut of my question.
Okay.
What I see is an offer to work collaboratively with us and other good-hearted people that want to solve this problem. But I really am interested at the bottom, at the end of the day, who gets to decide. Is it the governor's office or is it us? Right. And I'll just leave that. I don't want to. I'm not here to try to put you on the spot.
Well, Representative and Madam Chair, maybe I could jump in on this. I certainly have my ideas as an answer. And I certainly do anticipate a strong legislative role. And I think what we need is a real partnership with the governor's office and with the agency, which will implement it. And at this point, I'm seeing that kind of I'm seeing a shared interest for that kind of partnership. Certainly for me, on behalf of the work group, I think the work group is very interested in seeing this fund as a way to help move the needle on solving this problem. And I think the governor is interested in the same thing, mm-hmm. and I think the agency is. I will say that it was fortuitous that we were already having these conversations when the news of the settlement came down, because we've already been talking about these things and where the priority areas, you know, perhaps should be. Our colleagues in other states really don't know where to start on this issue. They haven't really been thinking about it. And so my concern there, frankly, on behalf of them, is that they'll just spend the money and not be very strategic about how it's spent. I think it's going to be crucial for us to spend this money very strategically.
Thank you, Senator.
Follow-up?
I got ahead of myself. Thank you. My other follow-up has to do with the nexus between federal money and our state efforts to work on the diesel problem. Do we have a ballpark? I'm going to make an assumption that we may be leaving federal money on the table right now because we can't quite get to all the retrofits of diesel engines that we'd like to. Is that a correct assumption, and do we have an idea of how much federal match we might be leaving on the table right now? Setting aside the VW money for now.
You're asking the right person. Kevin is the master of the scrounge.
Yes. Chair Peterson, Representative Helm. I think we're leaving no money on the table at this point. From the federal side, we work very hard in terms of trying to make it all happen here. I'm very selfish that way in terms of one of the strategies we've used recently is that EPA offers money through the Diesel Emissions Reduction Act through a competitive process within Region 10, so we're competing against Alaska, Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. And to a certain extent, we've been staff limited in terms of being able to do that work within DEQ in terms of administering grants. And so what we've been doing is actually going out and recruiting other partners to actually apply for the grants and manage them. And so partners like the Columbia Corridor Association, like Beyond Toxics, like the Metropolitan Contractors Improvement Partnership, qualifying organizations that can apply for these grants, and we effectively write up the documents so that they can submit that, and then they agree to administer the grant. And through that effort, we've been able to compete very well against Washington State for the regionally available funds. And so, although I'd love to get more, because I'm selfish that way, I think that we've been very successful in getting the money that has been made available for this kind of work.
Great. Glad to hear it. Thank you.
Representative Townsend.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Senator Dembrough, for being here and giving the thumbnail sketch on the work of our work group. I guess from my perspective, as somebody who's attended most of the meetings, it's one of these situations where I think the more we know about the issue, the more we don't know. And I think there's just a lot of blanks yet still to be filled in that I think to me clearly spells out the need for more data, the need for, if we're going to actually talk about regulating or incentivizing an industry, we need a registry, we need an inventory of, you know, we really don't know, we aren't able to delineate on-road versus off-road vehicles in Oregon yet. We really don't, and how they contribute to whatever particulate matter exists. We just don't have good tools yet to do that. And regarding California, again, as you well know, California's been at this for a number of years, and they've spent a lot of money on this issue, but it's not an apples-to-apples comparison there either, because the reason why they've been in this, and Kevin would certainly, reason why they've been in this effort is they were seriously in non-attainment. I mean, they're violating federal laws for particulate matter in large geographical areas. We don't have any, to my knowledge. Is that correct?
So, Representative Chair Peterson, Representative Johnson, we like the question you asked earlier.
Mm-hmm.
California's issue concerns about diesel exhaust is driven in part by concerns about the particulate non-attainment areas,
right,
like in the San Joaquin Basin and in the South Coast.
Right.
And the other drivers, frankly, is their concern, their identification of diesel itself, diesel PM, as a toxic air contaminant, which is, mm-hmm, like the conversation we had earlier, is a gap in the federal program that California has stepped up and identified and are addressing through their efforts. So it's driven by both of those concerns.
Sure.
And
I guess my larger point is that California and Oregon are very different in terms of the quality of their air related to diesel particulate matter. It's not an apples-to-apples comparison.
Right.
Madam Chair, if I could just jump in. I mean, one of the things that we've learned is that Multnomah County, anyway, is an area that is at really high risk as far as, you know, the cancer producing.
Higher risk, perhaps, than other parts of the state.
I mean, I think absolutely. I forget where it rates nationwide, but it's very high. I don't. Do you remember, Kevin?
I don't remember most recent analysis, but it's
right, it's really very
top
high.
50 counties in the country for concentrations of diesel particulate matter.
Right, and so for people who live in that area, they really are vulnerable to to a lot of this problem. And you know, I think that while I agree with you that there's a lot more data that we need to be developing around, particularly around the off-road construction equipment. And, you know, we have, I believe, been having productive conversations with the construction industry where we're hoping to partner with them on doing an inventory, something that would be done immediately upon, I would hope, immediately upon passage of legislation that would generate some dollars to do that, which would be a true partnership. So one of the problems, and you know this very well, that they had down in California was that they didn't partner up front about on their inventory, and the industry sued the Air Resources Board over what they had come up with, and they were proven to be correct, where if they had partnered up front and come up with good data, if, you know, industry had been really a full partner, had been asked to be a full partner, I think they would have avoided that problem and really shortened the amount of time that it's taken to address this. We can learn from their mistakes, and that's what I would hope to do. And, you know, let me say just, you know, in terms of regulation, if we're looking at regulation, we are looking at a long window. This is not something that could happen overnight. We just, you know, the very soonest that that anyone could be subject to any regulation would be 2021. And that's just the starting point. You know, I will say it's interesting. We did reach a point of agreement between environmentalists and industry on the work group the other day, where both agreed that we need to put any kind of timelines right into any legislation and not leave it up to DEQ. So the parties came together over their distrust of the EQC, if I can say that. But, you know, that is something that will be subject to a lot of conversation and I would think a lot of negotiation over the months to come.
Follow up.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing out some of the issues that California had, and it gets back to that question or that process of or procedure of modeling, using that as a tool to assume, you know, but obviously California, as you well know, found out that their modeling was off by a factor of like 300%, and that's what ensued, I think, the lawsuit that unraveled that whole thing. But getting back to something else you referenced a bit ago, Senator Denbrough, about leveraging efforts underway, and again, I would just throw it out that there have been some interesting conversations going on between kind of some quasi-public-private partnerships on this issue where PGE is into some really interesting talks with TriMet about how they could partner with TriMet under Senate Bill 1547, you're well aware, the electric vehicle incentives are freed up for the utilities, the IOUs, to get engaged. So what if PGE provided the infrastructure for the electrification of a portion of TriMet's diesel-powered fleet? And what if that happened in that portion of Portland you're talking about that may have the higher concentrations of particulate matter, and that become a pilot? And we could actually monitor and find out what is the impact on public health, what is the impact on air quality, and keep in mind that TriMet is the transit service for Portland Public School as well. So think about the benefits there for kids and folks that are riding, you know, if we suddenly now electrify that fleet. So seems, and not to mention carbon reduction at the same point in time. So there are those opportunities, I think, out there. So as we look for ways to invest some of this money, there may be some low-hanging fruit right in front of us. It may not necessitate a whole expensive, again, as we talk about a inventory and a regulatory system, it's going to involve cost to the agency to run this, obviously,
right,
which isn't a part of anybody's budget ask yet, as far as I know. So there may be some of this low-hanging fruit that we can invest in and I think really get some quantifiable outcomes in a relatively short period of time.
Well, thank you both for being here today to talk about the diesel issue. I appreciate all the work that you've done, Senator Denbrough, with the work group. And I actually think it's really good to have it with the diesel discussion happening with the Cleaner Air Oregon at once, because I think that, you know, if we look at the air quality in the state, you have, it's really a bigger umbrella of all of those different things and how they interact, the input on public health and impacts there. So it's a very good conversation. So thank you both very much. The last thing on the agenda committee is just a discussion about the 2017 committee bills. As everybody's aware, Monday is the deadline to get bill draft requests in if you want them to be pre-session filed. We're working on a couple of things. Specifically is one of the fixes for 1547 that we had talked about around the biomass that we had committed to doing last session, which will be a very small bill. If anyone else has things that they're interested in putting forward as a committee bill, I'm happy to open it up and have committee bills for folks if you for some reason you want to put it as a committee bill. With that, though, that is all the business I have for today. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you very much. With that, committee's adjourned.